We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Welcome to Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And welcome to Overnight America. A little chilly today, isn't it? Thanks for hanging out with us tonight. We'll be on for the next 4 hours and then the replay hour after midnight. Always a pleasure, though. Whenever we get this time together, I do enjoy it. So we keep the phone lines open at 314-436-7900. Or you could also call 800-925-1120. I'm on Twitter at Ryan Recker, and the podcast is up as soon as the hour ends, which sounds like a soap opera. As soon as the hour ends. Producer Mike's been out, and I've been waiting to tell him this story. I want you to listen, Producer Mike. I want you to give me your general impressions of what happened to me in St. Peter's over the weekend. Finally got to go out on a date night with my wife. We get to do a few of these a year. It's not too often, but it's often enough where when we get to go out, we enjoy it. And I had to convince her to go see a documentary with me called No Safe Spaces. It's the Adam Carolla, Dennis Prager documentary about freedom of speech and controlled thoughts and ideas on college campuses and compelled speech, all of those different things. And they spend a lot of time on the First Amendment, and they talk about just how much of a shame it is that you see freedom of expression and thoughts and ideas on college campuses where you should be sharing these things being discouraged. And it was a hard sell, but I was able to convince the wife to go do it. Well, we get to the movie theater. They're only showing it at a couple of different theaters, one in St. Peter's and one in Chesterfield. So we went down to the mall in St. Peter's, the Marcus Theater inside of the mall, and it was the right show time. So we get in there, and I have to use the restroom before the documentary starts, which is no big deal. So we get into our seats. The movie theater was not full at all. So we sit down, no problems. My wife's got the big tub of popcorn, and she's, you know, having a go at that while I excuse myself and I go to the restroom. Both stalls are taken, but one of the doors open and a guy comes out with a tub of popcorn. He went to the bathroom and he took his popcorn with him. No one really does that, right? Is that proper by any means? Can you think of a scenario where it's okay to take your popcorn inside of the stall with you?
No, I'm not a big fan of taking anything inside the stall. I see people here, you know, bringing their coffee mugs or their drinks inside the bathroom, and it's a little icky.
Yeah, the threshold where the door meets the tile, like, you know, the carpet meets the tile, you don't cross it. As far as I'm concerned, you don't bring any thing that you plan on putting in your mouth into that public bathroom.
My sister Erin, she's doing a traveling nursing stint right now in LA, and she traveled down to Anaheim to go to a Ducks Winnipeg Jets game.
Yeah.
And while she was there, she sent me a snap proclaiming her admiration for the fact that the Honda Center, where the Ducks play, have cup holders inside their stall. And all I could think was, that's disgusting.
That's kind of interesting. I see where there may be a need for that, because you have to travel a long distance between the concessions and you don't have a lot of time. You might just try to run in there, whatever it is, and you don't want to put it on the floor. But wouldn't the proper procedure be go to the bathroom first, then hit the concession? Wouldn't that be the right order? Because if you play it right, you could have went to the bathroom first, then went back, purchase your popcorn, and took your seat. You didn't have to buy the popcorn first and then find yourself sitting in a toilet stall. What if he was sneaking in, he just wanted some alone time? He was on a bad date and he really needed to just get away from it all. So he took the popcorn with him, and all he was doing was just sitting down and eating it in there, not actually using it as a toilet. There could be that scenario playing out. But that's the first time I've ever seen that. And really, the proper procedure is never take food into a public restroom, period. Never, ever, ever, ever. Even at my house, I can't think of a scenario where I brought food into the bathroom. Like,
so you saw him as he was leaving the bathroom and you were walking in?
Yeah.
So we can't confirm if he washed his hands or not?
No idea. He probably skipped that. He had to have. What did he do with the... Oh, I don't know. Didn't wash his hands. He's eating the popcorn with his hands? Now you just added a whole different gross thing to the equation. Ugh. Tub of popcorn in the bathroom stall. The guy may be listening right now. He wasn't in the documentary, I can tell you that, because I looked around to see if he was there, and I couldn't wait to go back and tell my wife in the theater, you won't believe what I just saw. And she was grossed out by it, too. It reminds me of that George Costanza moment on Seinfeld where he pulls the donut out of the trash can, and he acts like it's no big deal. It's a perfectly good donut just at the top of the trash can. Once it breaks the plane of the trash can, you don't eat it anymore. I mean, there must be a pretty big reason for you to want to grab that and eat that if it's not packaged in something else and you didn't just accidentally throw it away. But yeah, no thanks. Take the food into the bathroom. That's a big no-no. All right, so I'm glad we agree on something like this, and hopefully you don't see that sort of thing all too often. Yeah, anything open container in the bathroom makes it double worse, doesn't it? If it was like contained and, you know, sealed off, that's one thing. It's not like the person came out with a bag of, you know, whatever you'd buy, Hershey Kisses or something.
Right.
Skittles or whatever you'd buy at the concession. And then it was, you know, it wasn't opened. That's a whole different deal. But this is an open container full of popcorn. Did he have it on his lap? Where did he keep it when he was in there? I don't want to know. Ugh. So gross. Then it's got to be tainted by everything that's surrounding it. There's a level of it being tainted for sure. All right, coming up in the next segment, I wanted to just give you a quick trolley update. We got a lot to get to on the show. In this hour, Dr. Stephen Hatfield is going to join us in about 15 minutes from now. Are we really prepared for a flu pandemic? We go back about 100 years. There was a flu pandemic across the United States. A lot of people got sick and died. Are we prepared for another one of those? He's saying we're not. What would actually happen in 2019 if we had the exact same thing happen today? Next hour, though, Touro Clavel is the author of World Class, One Mother's Journey Halfway Around the Globe in Search of the Best Education for Her Children. So she traveled. She looked at the education system of many different countries. She's asked some suggestions of what we can do here in the United States. We'll talk to her at the start of the next hour. Our very own Megan Lynch, who you hear in the KMOX newsroom, she's been doing a series this week about urgent care, and it's a great series, so we're going to talk to her about that. Later in the show, too, Tom Sullivan is going to join us, an update on the Loop Trolley. He was there earlier today, and I had a few questions for him because he's got a few things and ideas of what should be happening with this Loop Trolley. I love his updates, so we'll talk to him later in the show, too. This is Overnight America, KMOX.
Radio's BS detector. Mark Reardon, weekday afternoons at 2 on St. Louis's News Radio, KMOX.
Overnight America continues. I can tell you, you're not going to find any popcorn in the restroom here at the KMOX studios. It is forbidden. This we command. So Dr. Stephen Hatfield is going to join us. Are we prepared for a flu pandemic? And he's saying we're actually not. We're actually not prepared at all. So what would actually happen if there was a flu pandemic in the United States? I found that other countries don't even bother with the flu shot. I was surprised about that. I was watching some people that post videos from other countries. The one from Sweden, very popular YouTuber out there, mentions that they don't do that in Europe. They don't do flu shots. It's like, oh, that's interesting. He said, that's just like an American thing. I wanted to mention really quickly, we're going to talk to Tom Sullivan later in the show, but the update that you hear on KMOX, Alex Degman brings it up too. The Post-Dispatch wrote an article on it. The executive board of the Bi-State Development Agency voted Tuesday to approve a request by CEO Talby Roach to negotiate a detailed proposal to take over the Loop Trolley. Oh, come on now. I don't like that they're humoring this idea. They shouldn't even humor it. It shouldn't even get to the point where they say, okay, give us your best shot, because we need at some point to realize this is still a terrible idea today. It's a terrible idea a month from now. It's a terrible idea 2 months from now. Doesn't matter when it happens, it's still going to be a terrible idea to try to assume the debt of this thing that by all certainty will continue to accrue debt. And from all certainty, you're going to be pulling money away from more important things, including Metrolink. If let's say that the Bi-State Development Agency says we're going to sink about $1 million a year into this thing because, you know, it's worth keeping around for the 100 people that ride it a day, if that, not even that. If you're lucky on a good, busy day, yeah, we're going to spend $1 million on this just so a couple people can ride it back and forth, and we'll just leave it at that. Or would you rather have, well, I don't know, maybe fulfilling some promises with the buses or Metrolink in the city and county in order to make things safer, in order to, I don't know, improve the areas that have been, I don't want to use the word plighted, but they're certainly not getting any better. Maybe we start looking at those first before you start throwing money into something that is not sustainable and not used. I think that would be the best approach. Roach presented a preliminary report to the board, estimated Bi-State could operate the trolley over the next 4 years with a little more than $1 million in reappropriated federal grants to Bi-State. Oh my goodness, more federal grants. You know what the crazy thing about all of this is? They say if we were to let this fold, it would look bad on the region. And if we were to let this fold, it may jeopardize other projects that they would want to invest in this region. I would say this has already been a nationally recognized disappointment. I think it's pretty safe to say that when the Wall Street Journal and New York Times and all these national media outlets start writing about this failed loop trolley, that maybe that would be the thing that they quote next time we apply for some funds, as in, we know even if we were to give them this money, there's no guarantee it's going to be used the way they said it would be used. It's not going to be sustainable the way they said it would be sustainable. And by all means, why would we give them this if we know that there's a high risk of them losing money and then having to go through this conversation of this all over again? Because we know they're not going to just keep reappropriating money from somewhere. It's not like the city of St. Louis and the county and even the Bi-State region has money flowing out of every pocket. Every time I look around, in full bloom, the money trees, for whatever reason, are not blooming. We're not collecting like we should. We're ignoring revenue avenues, you know, such as trying to enforce all of the temporary tags that continue to go unpunished over and over and over again, and people evading that tax. Maybe we start looking at some of these other options. So how about we look at the current laws that we have on the books right now and find some of those that are not being enforced, and maybe the ones that have been relaxed for whatever reason, and use that as a way to try to make up for some of the shortfall before you say, well, what we need to do is take about, you know, $500,000 here, $500,000 there, $1 million here, $1 million there, away from something that is already underfunded. And what about all these other promises they made to Metrolink? I mean, how many other promises have they made to say they're going to improve this thing? And it still hasn't gotten any better. And we're still seeing security issues. And we're still seeing people that are afraid to ride this thing, and rightfully so. And we're still seeing that every time, you know, like Elliot Davis, for example, did that video not that long ago. And he wanted to illustrate a point. He hops on, and he said it was a full hour before he saw any security. He'll do these reports where he'll live stream. He'll go to some of these platforms where there should be security, and there's no one there. You know, people hop on these things. It's dangerous. They see, hold on, I keep this one witness account in my stack of, okay, here we go. I keep this one witness account just so I could illustrate the problems with Metrolink anytime we talk about it. There's a detectable security problem. One person said, people blasting from their phones, screaming up and down cars, holding doors open forever, buying and selling literally everything, pills, weed, meth, shoes, pizzas, headphones, train hopping to evade ticket guards, drunks, smokers, crazy shouting dudes, and the list goes on and on and on. And it says, morning commuters aren't selling drugs and hopping fares. A lot of this stuff is happening in the afternoons. Never have they seen a city cop on a train anywhere. And this is not just one person going online and sharing an experience that happened to them just once, and everything was just, oh, this is an isolated incident. Every time we talk about this, I don't know how many people have called in and said these are the exact same problems we see over and over again. So let me ask you this. Would you rather us sink some more money into something that we know will guarantee never raise enough money to be self-sufficient. We're going to have to keep sinking more and more money into a novelty, a cosmetic deal. Or should you fix something that's actually used by a lot of people in order to help and benefit the people that are using it? I mean, Metrolinx, even though the attendance is way lower than it used to be, it's still not, it's still nowhere near where it needs to be. Real quick, let me get to Mick in Fenton, who's calling in. Hi, Mick. Oh, sorry.
Good night.
Hi, good.
Hey, are all these other trolleys that are all over the country, I mean, did they all cost $26 million per mile? Or wasn't that the number, $26-something million dollars per mile?
Yeah, that's a good question. We should look at how much it costs to install in the other places that were given that grant. That's a great question. I don't know.
And I've listened to the director of one of these deals that, you know, talking about the, you know, the cars weren't delivered on time, and they hired all this staff to test these cars, and this was mandatory. I, as a business owner, have bid on federal projects, and there are deadlines to me. And if these cars were not delivered at the proper time, why didn't millions of dollars in penalties be paid to help this organization that is now saying they need another $500,000 to keep going? This was a boondoggle from the beginning. I just wonder how much money Mr. Blueberry Hill pocketed out of this whole deal.
Yeah, Mick, the big question is, why hasn't the audit of this started? Because I think everyone wants to see it. Even our lawmakers, senators, governor, they all want to see an audit of this thing to know where the money went. That should happen first.
Why can't they audit it?
No, that should happen first before any more taxpayer money is sunk into this thing. We need to know what the money, because I can tell you right now, it doesn't make any sense to me that this was spent in a way that was responsible. There's no possible way 50-some million dollars later for a two-mile track. Come on now.
Come on, man.
All right. Thanks, Mick. Good to hear from you.
See you.
All right. Bye. Yeah. How about the condition should be no longer will this thing operate, or no more taxpayer money will be sunk into this until the audit is completed. I think that would be completely fair. You got to know what you're getting into. And I said this yesterday, and we'll talk to Tom Sullivan about this later in the show. One of my main points is if you were to acquire a business, much like we're looking at what's happening with the buy state right now, if you as a business owner is thinking about acquiring another business, what's one of the very first things you do? You open up the books and you take a look at their finances, and that gives you a pretty clear picture of what you're about to get yourself into. You need all of those things. It's not standard. It's required. It's mandatory. Now, if you're going to take over and essentially buy this trolley and assume the responsibilities associated with it, why wouldn't you require to open up the books? You got to get that audit done first. And this is your money, your taxpayer money. And give me a break, anyone in Illinois, what kind of crazy talk is it that someone that would be part of this bi-state development agency that lives in Illinois would look at this as a benefit to them? You know? Not even close to a benefit for them. All of the people that with a vote in Illinois should shoot this down. I mean, there shouldn't even be a consideration on their side. You got to think. You got to think logically here. And there's no logical way to find an acceptable way to keep this thing going. All right, we're going to talk about this later in the show. Dr. Stephen Hatfield is going to join us next. Are we actually prepared for a flu pandemic? He says we're not. We'll let him explain next on Overnight America KMOX.
Now back to Overnight America on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
One thing I know about anything is that you can't propagate the necessary aid quick enough. We see it with hurricanes, we see it with floods, we see it with tornadoes. Never fast enough. What if there was a nationwide pandemic? How much trouble would the United States be in? Joining us now is the author of a new book. His name is Dr. Stephen Hatfield. Thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Good evening to you.
It's an interesting look at what would happen. Are we prepared for a flu pandemic that could kill millions? Your new book is called 3 Seconds Until Midnight, and your website, 3secondsuntilmidnight.com. 1918, we had a flu pandemic, killed a lot of people worldwide. When you go back and you do some research on that, do you see any parallels to some of the things that may be happening in present day?
Yes, quite a number, especially with respect to the countermeasures that will be used to combat an outbreak this serious of an infectious disease.
You say the countermeasures. I mentioned right before, in the United States, and if we just look at this country, you know, we're pretty good at getting aid and help out, but it still takes time when you're working with a large group of people, millions of people that need help. Imagine, you know, 300 million people that would need help for something like this. It seems like it's almost impossible to be prepared, let alone if you go worldwide. How in the world would we be able to help everyone?
Well, for helping everyone worldwide, there is not a lot that we would be able to do except promote a vaccine development. Mm-hmm. With respect to the United States, the actual planning for any sort of disaster is the local communities. Mm-hmm. A pandemic, a lethal pandemic of infectious communicable disease sweeping through a country. If the local communities can handle the local epidemic in their area, then the nation can handle a pandemic.
Hmm.
The problem is our local authorities are not prepared.
Yeah.
We're 50,000 healthcare workers short of what we need, and it's not being given the proper seriousness.
Can you give us a history lesson of what happened in 1918?
In 1918, beginning out in Kansas in the winter, an unusual influenza strain broke out. And this was characterized by, normally in influenza, it's the very young and the very old that have the worst time. This one seemed to be affecting the younger people, the fit, healthy males. Mm-hmm. It broke out in a small area in Kansas and swept through a nearby military cantonment area. Made it all the way to overseas. The United States had just entered ground combat in World War I. And then it seemed to disappear.
Hmm. You know, how many years was this a problem?
It came back. It came back within a few months. And the virus had mutated into a strain that caused rampant lung damage in healthy adults.
Yeah.
More soldiers were lost from this Group A influenza strain than all the bullets on both sides of the war.
Wow.
And it got into the civil population in the United States.
Altogether, how many people died in that flu pandemic?
It keeps being revised upwards. For years, it was estimated to be 20 million globally. Then it was revised up to 50 million, and arguably, it's probably around 100 million.
Wow, that's a lot.
Now the population of the world was half of what it is now.
Mm.
And our population densities, you know, there's this big, people are flocking to the cities for employment.
Yeah.
And this urbanization is a global phenomenon now. So things that happen today, we're facing a whole new set of problems that really weren't around in 1918, where Americans were more self-sufficient.
Mm. Dr. Stephen Hatfield's joining us with the new book, 3 Seconds Until Midnight. And that's the website, 3secondsuntilmidnight.com. What happened in 1918 compared to today, in the sense that I feel most people would be more equipped to fight the flu on a personal level between the different medications that are available, the vaccines, the flu shots? It seems like more people would prepare themselves. It seems like in 2019, it would be a lot harder for a flu pandemic to spread around.
Well, here's the problem. The antiviral drugs are very limited. The ones that have been stockpiled by the United States in their own national strategic stockpile, there's still some controversy those three drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And also in past outbreaks, recent outbreaks of seasonal influenza the viruses involved have shown to develop resistance quite quickly. Mm-hmm. So a vaccine cannot be made until you actually know what strain of virus is causing the pandemic. And at the moment, it's a six-month period to provide suitable amounts of vaccine. Because we grow it up in fertilized chicken eggs. Now, there's some recent and encouraging attempts to shift over to cell culture-based technologies, but it will still be about 3 months before any significant quantity of vaccine is present, and the epidemic wave could have passed by then, or reaching the peak of the epidemic. So we've only stockpiled about 81 million doses of antiviral drug. This was to cover essential personnel, politicians, the military, until the vaccine could be developed. We only have 81 million doses of I believe it's still a questionable drug. The CDC still promotes it. And this vaccine gap. So people are going to be related to the same, what we call non-pharmaceutical countermeasures, as what they were in 1918. 123 to 125 million people aren't going to receive anything, vaccine or drugs, until the peak of the epidemic is almost past. So these non-pharmaceutical countermeasures are basically, if you cough, do it into your sleeve if you're out, if you're in company. Don't go to work if you're sick, and frequently wash your hands. And stay away from others. Well, that's impossible in our modern cities.
I wonder, you mentioned this, just basically with the 80-some million of these stockpile the United States has when it comes to this, trying to fight if there was some sort of flu pandemic. But from what you were saying before, there could be a certain strain. Could that 80-some million of the stockpile actually be irrelevant and useless, depending on how the strain plays out?
Sure. This this drug that we've stockpiled, and they've stockpiled some other antivirals, but not in these quantities. These are mainly drugs for influenza. We're seeing now this whole concept of emerging infectious diseases. About one or two brand new diseases are infecting man that we've never seen before in science.
Wow. You know, in other countries, they wear those surgical masks when they're sick. They go through some pretty big lengths or some pretty serious precautions to make sure they don't make anyone else sick. Not here in the United States. I don't think there's anyone that does anything when they try to think of the courtesy of making sure everyone else stays healthy if you're sick. You're right. We go to work. We do all of these other things. We touch the same doorknobs. We do all the same things, and it's no wonder why one person comes into work sick. So many other people get sick, too.
Well, you know, also wearing the mask, it's a good thing if you're sick, because it stops you, if you cough or sneeze, from generating these small particle aerosols that can hang around in the air for a couple hours. But the eye is actually a target for influenza infection of all the major strains that have been looked at in the laboratory. So you walk into a room, somebody's been coughing in there, these droplets are suspended, and the surface tension draws it into your eye. Within 30 minutes, that's in your nasal cavity and your upper airway.
We're not
keeping up with the latest research in our national planning.
Yeah, I mean, we see each year when there's a flu outbreak in a city, in St. Louis included, there's normally reports of people that die based on the flu, and you know, it's normally a couple of people a year, depending on how serious the flu is. We may have more precautions that are taken in certain areas. I'm wondering what you think would be the hardest hit areas if there was a pandemic. Let's say it was more than what we've seen in 100 years. What areas do you think would get hit the hardest?
These would be our mega cities. We have two of these, New York, in San Francisco.
Los Angeles?
San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, Los Angeles, not San Francisco. But the problem is, these are part of mega regions. So this whole New York East Coast area coming down, and the same out in California, There's, I think, six of these in the United States. If you look at one of the satellite photos on Google of the United States at night, you can see these huge interlinked areas that are very dependent on a constantly available workforce for all the infrastructure of the city.
Mm-hmm.
If you start losing enough workers due to death or illness, you start running the risk of infrastructure problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the food doesn't just magically get into the supermarkets and corner grocery stores. It's very dependent on a very complex system of delivery trucks and warehousing, which themselves are very, very dependent on having an adequate fuel supply.
You know,
these are all interconnected.
I want to talk to you about what you think some of the solutions would be to this. You know, I'm sure the United States has gone through a couple of rounds of sitting around a big board table and figuring out what they're going to be doing next. I'm curious what you think the solutions are. Do you mind holding on until after the break?
Certainly.
Let's do that. Dr. Stephen Hatfill, he's the author of the new book, 3 Seconds Until Midnight, the website 3secondsuntilmidnight.com. Kind of a scary thought. Are we prepared for a flu pandemic that could kill millions? We'll get some of his solutions, what we could do to better prepare ourselves next on Overnight America KMOX.
Now back to Overnight America on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
So are we prepared for a flu pandemic that could kill millions? That's a good question. It's a serious question. Very serious question. Joining us, the principal author of the new book, 3 Seconds Until Midnight, Dr. Stephen Hatfill. Thank you for hanging on.
Oh, my pleasure.
So the big question is, what do you think we could be doing better, at least for the United States, to prepare ourselves for a flu pandemic?
Well, the federal government has kept their portion of the influenza pandemic response plan. They've established a strategic national stockpile, and they have, in addition to that, they're responsible for rapidly creating a new vaccine. There's research now towards universal flu vaccine that'll handle all the strains. This research is progressing ahead. There's also some better drugs out there that they could be stockpiling.
Mm.
The real problem comes down to the local authorities, the communities. The local hospitals in this type of a 1918 event are going to require a 200% increase in hospital beds and a 400% increase in the number of ventilators and ICU beds.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to staff that? These things all require some pre-planning. They're called alternate care sites and neighborhood emergency health centers. These are buildings of pre-designated that can be turned into small clinics.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Bringing doctors out of retirement.
Hmm.
Nursing students, if you happen to have a nursing school. This type of thing. And it's the community itself decides how they're going to handle this tremendous influx of cases, how they're going to train the population in their area. Again, coughing into your sleep, closing the movie theaters, closing the restaurants, avoiding and minimizing person-to-person contacts in the area.
So if you were to try to handicap the likelihood of having a widespread pandemic. I mean, we've seen some years where it's been worse than others, and we've seen some years where, you know, there's some several reported deaths in any given region. What do you think the likelihood is we see something to the scale of 1918 sometime in the future?
Well, I think I'm joined by a lot of scientists and physicians that it will happen again.
Mm.
It's a question of time, whether it'll be influenza or some other respiratory contagious infection, it will happen again.
Hmm.
We're living at population densities that are completely abnormal. No other species of large mammal has ever achieved our high density population
globally.
So we're all living in a bit of a grand experiment.
Mm-hmm.
One of my chief worries is what I call the poor disadvantaged communities in our 120 largest cities. These people are not in a tier to receive antiviral medications or limited stores of vaccine, but these are the more vulnerable communities in the United States. These are the ones most likely not to adhere to these non-pharmaceutical interventions. Some of these areas are completely bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the people that are going to become infected with the worst mortality, the worst number of hospitalizations. These are going to overcrowd the community hospital.
Mm-hmm.
It's these areas of our cities that need to be concentrated on first.
Hmm.
According both to real world data and computer simulations.
Yeah. You know, it was, I've read some books about the bubonic plague and how that almost had an outbreak here in the United States and the extreme measures they went through in order to stop that from happening in California. I mean, they sent all of the brightest doctors and anyone that would be working on contagious diseases, I think it was to San Francisco, where there could have been just a giant outbreak. And one of the big problems they had is something that you're talking about. You have these certain communities that were there, and when you go back to your early 1900s, they were afraid of being kicked out of the country, so they didn't tell anyone they had these problems. So you think about today, high density areas like Los Angeles, where there may be a lot of people living in the country illegally that may be afraid that if they say something, they'll be deported. So what happens in thing like that, it just incubates and gets larger, 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 and next thing you know, it gets out of control. You could see something like that happening.
Yes. Yeah. Most certainly. Yeah. It's a big problem, and it needs to be taken very seriously by local authorities.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government have done what they can and what they said they would do. The states are actually getting pretty good at their planning on. When this stuff comes from the national stockpile, how do you get it to the areas and towns and cities where it's needed?
Mm-hmm.
They've actually got some reasonable plans, but the local authorities just don't seem to be doing anything.
Yeah.
If they have a plan, it hasn't been actively rehearsed. It's a tabletop exercise. And they run through this, and there's no after-action reports or suggestions for improving the response. They don't keep rosters mm-hmm. of people that would be available to help in a pandemic. And we have no pandemic assistant training programs in the United States. We're going to need drivers, personal assistants, hospital assistants, this type of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just the hospital, it's the laundry. Mm. It's the meals served in the hospital. It's the whole structure.
It's the whole structure. Well, you know what? Yeah. Just real quick, if people wanted to find out more, they can just go to the website 3secondsuntilmidnight.com. Is that the best place to go?
Sure. That's the place.
Dr. Stephen Hatfill. Very fascinating look at this and a very serious thing we should be keeping in mind. Thank you so much for coming on to Overnight America.
Pleasure talking with you. Have a good evening.
You too. And again, 3secondsuntilmidnight.com if you wanted to check out more. He joins us on the Quiver River Electric KMOX guest line.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.